I put water on them reeds over there so that they wouldn't fire underneath the bridge.
Last spring's wildfire in Kansas and Oklahoma was the biggest wildfire in the history of Kansas. A rancher caught in the midst of the roaring fire explained to the Kansas City Star in a video what it was like to see the flames spread.
With the wind and the way things were, the firefighters were already coming out of Freedom. But with the way things were, you knew it was going to be bad.
In a matter of days, the fire scorched more than 400,000 acres, damaging properties and homes, killing livestock. Environmental advocates blame dry conditions and increasing temperatures, signs of climate change, and they expect more wildfires in the future, as well as flooding and severe weather. So, yeah, not exactly the kind of party you want to be invited to. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And today, we want to know what's at stake in our region as climate change becomes a reality. If you have a question for our guests, call 816-235-2888. Let's start with Jerry Schnorr. He's based out of the University of Iowa, where he co-directs the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research. Hi, Jerry.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Most conversations about climate change come at it from a global perspective, which makes sense. It's a global challenge, and we're all facing it together. But is it important to approach the topic regionally as well?
Certainly, most decisions are taken at policy decisions are taken at the regional or local scale. So that's really where our efforts play out. So it's true that we should think locally and think globally and act locally and regionally.
Does what climate change looks like in the Midwest specifically, does that matter, or is it like we might as well be focused on glaciers because it's all part of the same picture?
Well, certainly climate change is already here. And in general, if you talk about the entire globe, wet areas are getting wetter and dry areas are getting drier. And that means, of course, especially for West Kansas, for example, that's a dry area. The air is warmer than it used to be, so that when you have only a little bit of soil moisture, it evaporates even quicker. So we can expect dry areas to get drier, like West Kansas, and we can expect wet areas to get wetter, like my own Iowa is experiencing frequent flooding. The global rainfall rate, we think, is increasing. We have pretty good evidence for that from satellites, and that's because the seas are warmer. The average sea surface temperature in the last 50 years has increased about 1 degree Fahrenheit.
Tom Jacobs, Director of Environmental Programs at Kansas City's Mid-America Regional Council, is with us too. And Tom, what do you think? When something really is global in scope, like climate change, why talk about it from a specifically Midwestern perspective?
It's an interesting thing, right? There's all these different studies that project global changes in climate and extreme weather. But people in Kansas City wonder, well, what does it mean for us? And there's a number of very specific changes that we might anticipate related to changes in temperature and precipitation regimes. And so we've tried to take a look at that so we can understand what the impacts might be related to public health, for example, or infrastructure, or other issues of concern.
Can you talk a little more specifically about what it is that you do expect in the Midwest?
Absolutely. We had the pleasure of working with a climatologist from Iowa State University named Chris Anderson, who generated what he called a downscaled model for the Kansas City region. So he looked at global models and he tried to project, well, what does it mean for our area? And he identified a number of potential changes for the Kansas City region that can be generally grouped into two categories, one related to precipitation and the other temperature. So he projects that by the year 2100, we might anticipate rainfall increasing from about 39 inches a year to just under 45 inches per year. But the kicker is the annual precipitation numbers aren't really the most important thing. It's how much comes at a particular time. What are the risks of flooding? What are the potential risks to water quality? We haven't yet been
Because a few inches, I mean, maybe I'm just naive, but a few inches per year doesn't seem like a huge difference.
So the thing about climate change is the average annual numbers aren't really the main message. It's what happens at the extremes. What are the risks of increased flooding from larger events or more intense events or events that are spaced closer together?
What's the answer to that question? Do we know?
No, we really don't know. And it's interesting for our community with respect to rainfall that on one hand we might be wetter, but at the same time during the drier summer months we might see longer numbers of consecutive dry days. So on one hand, we'll be wetter, and on the other hand, we'll be drier, and that could have implications for agriculture or public health or water supply or different things.
Well, I want to get back into some of the really specific projections. But first, when we're talking about the Midwest, where specifically are we talking about? I mean, I'd like to hear both of your answers because we might be working with different definitions of the Midwest. Tom, I'll start with you.
So the work that we have done concerns the Kansas City metro area. And of course, we understand that our situation is embedded within a larger Midwestern and global context. But we've been trying to identify what some of the specific risks and vulnerabilities might confront our metropolitan area. And so MARC is defined by a 9-county area. And we are using that within community planning processes to try and anticipate what might be coming at us and how we can address it.
So very close to home in that case. Jerry Schnorr, what is your definition of the Midwest?
When we look regionally, you have to define climatological regions. And one group from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has published simulations of global climate models and then regional models embedded in those. Now, each regional model has its own characteristics. And Kansas City, for example, is a part of the Central Plains, as is Iowa, and that's generally regarded as becoming wetter and warmer. However, again, West Kansas is a part of the Central Plains. And Central Plains are, in general, thought to be dry, especially drier in the summer, hotter, warmer and drier. And perhaps the models don't agree very well in the fall and the winter, but perhaps a bit wetter in the fall and the winter. And that's projected out to 2061.
So, but just to get back to this question of defining the Midwest, Where do you think are the lines around that region?
Well, again, the climatological regions, there's several in the Midwest, depending on where you define the geographical Midwest.
So defining the Midwest is maybe less important to you than defining
the climatological regions, how they, and again, Kansas would look to become wetter and warmer, Kansas City, and Western Kansas drier and warmer.
So let's...
And it's already perhaps happening, the impacts on the Ogallala Aquifer, for example, in West Kansas.
That's exactly where I want to go. I mean, I want to ask you, what has already happened and what is right now happening? And Jerry, I'll start with you on that.
Well, for some time, the Ogallala has been the main source of water, as you know, for agriculture and for people. In a large portion of Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. And because of that, it's been overdrawn. That means that the rate of withdrawals are greater than the rate of natural recharge of the aquifer.
How long has that been happening?
Oh, pretty much as long as settlement has occurred, but locally, but I would say it's especially acute in the last 30 years or so.
Has that been related to changes in temperature and rainfall?
Yes, and also, again, probably the main variable is withdrawals, again. So as we irrigate more land for agriculture, then there's less water available in the aquifer, and we're drawing it down such that several places already have essentially no saturated thickness. In other words, you could have gotten water there, say, a decade ago, but you can no longer. And there's some rather broad areas in southwest Kansas that could also lose the ability to pump water from them, let's say, within the next 10 to 30 years or so.
So we have, at least over the last 30 years in an acute way, been seeing a problem already with water access issues, water availability issues, sort of on the increase.
As the atmosphere, you know, is warmer, then surface soil temperatures are warmer also, and that causes increased evaporation.
What are some of the other ways that climate change has already been affecting our region?
Besides precipitation, that would be the most important one, I would say, for the listeners on your show. But also temperature, our nights are warmer. That's because the moisture doesn't allow the heat to escape into space. So we have warmer nights. Some good things that could happen also, like we have longer growing seasons. And I think farmers are already taking advantage of that. So those are some of the other effects.
Tom, is there anything you'd like to add to that list?
It's interesting. The changes that we're observing enable us to continue to deal with some of the problems we've had for a long time. We've dealt with flooding in Kansas City for a long time. We've prepared for it. We've built infrastructure to be able to respond to it. Climate change might perhaps increase the risk of flooding and enable us to take another look at how our systems work and if there's opportunities to do a better job in terms of being prepared.
Can I jump in on this flooding issue? Because it might seem really counterintuitive to a lot of people that we are facing both a depletion issue, a lack of supply when it comes to water, and at the same time facing a risk of flooding.
Well, I think we need to differentiate the issues between western Kansas and eastern Kansas.
Right.
So the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer is one thing. We happily have abundant water supply in Kansas City through the Missouri River, so that's less of a concern here. But we might have increased risk of flooding, and as the soil dries out during the summer months, there could be risks to infrastructure in different kinds of ways.
So any other big picture kinds of categories of challenge or categories of change, I mean even neutral change, that you might anticipate?
Yeah, so I had mentioned there are two big things to think about. One is changes in precipitation, and the other has to do with temperature. So one projection that Dr. Anderson generated for the year 2100 suggests that the number of days per year in which the temperature exceeds 105 degrees Fahrenheit will increase from 0.7 days per year to almost 22 days per year. And so that has all kinds of different implications. I think perhaps the most significant of which might relate to public health. So we've heard about deaths related to heat exposure in Kansas City and in Chicago and elsewhere, and thinking about how we can work with vulnerable populations that might be most affected by those kinds of changes is something that I think is a real concern.
Can you explain a little more? I mean, it sounds like you're saying that not everyone is affected by that particular problem equally. I mean, why would some people be more vulnerable than others?
So it's interesting. The literature shows that the impacts of climate change are likely to be disproportionately distributed in, around the world and around different kinds of communities. So when I go home, if it's really hot out, I can turn on the air conditioner. But what happens if I don't have an air conditioner or if I don't have enough money to pay the air conditioning bill and my electricity's turned off? So thinking about opportunities to address that enables us to think about, well, how can we make homes more energy efficient so energy bills are lower? How can we reduce urban heat islands so the energy we don't have to cool the air as much?
Is that also what you're referring to when you talk about public health issues?
Well, there's on the public health side, there's all kinds of different issues that arise. The Center for Disease Control has published some really interesting work. When it gets hotter, that creates opportunities to increase the rate of ozone formation, which is air quality concern for our metro area. So as ozone formation increases, there's different risks to folks with different sorts of respiratory diseases like asthma. At the same time, maybe there's opportunities for increased exposure to allergens, right, because the growing season is longer. So maybe folks who suffer from different sorts of allergies might have problems. There could be other sorts of issues related to water quality. We hear about algal blooms in different parts. That kind of problem could be exacerbated. So there's a whole range of different sorts of health issues that could arise, and this issue of heat exposure is one of those.
Jerry,
certainly, vector-borne disease, mosquitoes would be one that could be a concern regarding warmer days.
Absolutely.
Jerry, talk to me a little bit more about what else you're seeing. I mean, we heard about fires earlier on in the show. Are fires an issue related to climate change?
Yes, certainly. When the air is warmer and the soils are warmer, there's more of a tendency for fires. But we manage our lands so intensely that it's kind of difficult to say statistically that climate change has played a big role there. We have had record fire seasons, as you're as the beginning of the program alluded to, and certainly warmer summers do not help in terms of fires. But some of it has been arson, as you know, and some of it has been how we manage our forests and whether we manage for lightning or controlled burning or not. If not, then fuel builds up on the floor of the forest and certainly exacerbates the forest fires that we've been experiencing.
So fires are kind of an area where it's hard to tease apart one cause from another.
I think so, yes.
Well, you know, this might sound like a flippant question, but there are people who, you know, we are having a November where the weather's in the 70s most days, and you might hear people sort of casually say something like, thanks, global warming. I mean, are the high temperatures we're experiencing right now in November, is that just a coincidence, or is that part of this equation?
Well, we have set some records, as you know, but it's not unprecedented to have warm Novembers, and any one climatological event manifested in weather, say for this past week or so, it's difficult to point to climate change as being the sole cause of that. But what a person can say is that the frequency of warm Novembers, for example, will increase in a warmer world, which we're already beginning to experience. And so the frequency, the probability of that increases, that means we're likely to have more warm days in November as we're experiencing now.
I think we probably need to at least quickly address the fact that not everyone takes climate change seriously. There are people out there who think it's a hoax. And I know we can't completely tackle that giant issue right now, but what can you tell us about how researchers know what they know about this? How do you guys come to your conclusions? Jerry?
Are you asking a question, how do we know that climate change is real and caused by humans? Well, there's really multiple lines of evidence. There's a massive amount of evidence from space, from satellite measurements, from ground-based measurements, from sea observations, from fossils, from ice cores, from tree rings. It's almost like a lawyer would lay out his or her case with multiple lines of evidence, all pointing to the same direction. And, in fact, we know that greenhouse gases, which are accumulating, do indeed warm the atmosphere. We know that for a fact and have known that for over 150 years.
Jerry, we'll pick up with this a little bit when we come back. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll also turn our focus to what's happening with forests. I'm Gina Kaufman. Call 816-235-2888 with your questions about climate change in the Midwest. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and as much as I'd like to report that the Midwest is in a protected little bubble when it comes to climate change, that's not what our guests have been telling us this morning. We've been chatting with Jerry Schnorr from the University of Iowa's Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research. Hi again, Jerry. I'm not hearing Jerry. We'll get Jerry back in a moment. We've got Tom Jacobs in the studio. He's with us from the Mid-America Regional Council. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And Jerry, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Jerry, I'd like you to maybe pick up where you left off for a moment.
Thanks, Gina. I was about to say that for me, the smoking gun of all this evidence started in 2005 with a program called the Argo buoys. And these are solar-powered buoys that float continuously in the ocean. We have over 4,000 of them now. You can go online and even see where they're floating, and they record continuously the temperature and salinity at depth down below 2,000 meters in the ocean. So we have very accurate measurements now of the heat in the ocean. And the heat is where the ocean is where you'd want to go to look for where's this excess heat from human-caused greenhouse gases. So first the atmosphere warms, and then it's transferred into the oceans. And we can see it there very plainly. In fact, the amount of heat that's being stored each year is immense. It's more than 20 times the total amount of fossil fuels, the heat generated from burning all the fossil fuels on Earth every year. And it's being stored in the oceans. It's changing the ocean temperatures. And that, in turn, is changing the rate of evaporation, the amount of moisture in the air, and all these other changes that we've been talking about on the air today.
Tom, is there anything you'd like to add about how the researchers you work with know what they know and do what they do, methodology kind of stuff?
Well, I'd add that I'm not a scientist, but I'm often told climate change is an observation, not a belief. And so as folks like Jerry conduct research around the world, around the country, around the Midwest region, we have extensive data sets that demonstrate substantial change in climate. And so my job isn't to debate whether or not changes in climate are occurring. It's how do we respond to that, right? We don't know exactly what our future holds, but we can begin to prepare for different kinds of futures to mitigate against the kinds of risks and vulnerabilities that our community might expect to face.
Well, yeah, in case you are feeling really depressed by this conversation, Tom has got some ideas of ways we can start to address some of these problems, and we will be getting to those, I promise. But for now, I want to bring a scientist in on this conversation. Neil Peterson's a senior ecologist and researcher at Harvard, and he's been hanging around in forests. Hi, Neil.
Hi, how are you?
I am pretty good. How about you?
I'm well. I'm very honored to be a part of this conversation. I've really enjoyed it so far.
What have you been doing in the Ozark forests?
So in spring 2015, Park Williams, who's a bioclimatologist at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, and I joined up to do a study to look at climate sensitivity of the forests in your region, in the Ozarks. And it really sprung from a couple observations. First, Park was looking at tree ring records across the United States and North America. And one thing he spotted is those that are in the Ozarks, in that region, collected by David Staley of the University of Arkansas, showed that they had a very strong negative correlation to daytime temperatures in the summer.
What does that mean? Because and also maybe explain what you mean by tree ring research.
Oh, yeah, tree ring research. So everyone knows that you can look at the rings of a tree and you can tell how old it is, but it's actually way cooler than that. We can see, as you described in the beginning of the show, wide rings can represent this, narrow rings can represent that. But there's just so much information buried within the rings that we can extract long-term histories in areas where there might not have been observations by humans or meteorological stations. And so Park took these records and he looked at them and he found out that hot summer days in that region actually reduce tree growth. It's a part of the drought stress, the water stress that trees experience. And warm temperatures in the summer are probably the strongest driver of this relationship. And I think most interesting to me and him and a few other folks is in that region, these have the strongest, most adverse responses to high temperatures in the United States. And then Scott St. George of the University of Minnesota did this for the Northern Hemisphere. And your region, the Ozark region, is still one of the trees in those regions are still one of the most sensitive, the most adversely affected by hot temperatures. And we wanted to know why, and we wanted to know what that might mean for the forests.
Do you have answers yet, or is it going to take a while longer to have that?
Well, Park was visiting yesterday, and we got some preliminary results. And the data that David Staley of the University of Arkansas collected were very specific samples to actually reconstruct drought history in that region. And so he's looking at very specific locations where the trees are going to be drought stressed or water limited every year. We wanted to know, is that representative of the forest, or is that just a special case? So we we sampled from Van Buren, Missouri to eastern Oklahoma, and we collected four different species in normal forest conditions. And what we found yesterday, very preliminary, very new evidence, is that these trees are actually almost as adversely affected by hot summer days as these special collections that David Staley made. And I think the most interesting thing that we're trying to tease out, well, Park is trying to tease out right now, is that the effect of the sun is one of the strongest factors. So really sunny days in the summer adversely affect the trees in that region. That's what it seems like.
So that's, you know, in the Ozarks, in the Midwest more broadly, well, first, what is your definition of the Midwest? Because I think that everyone might view that term a little differently.
Yeah, you know, I lived in Kentucky for 5 years, and I'm just still grappling with that definition of what is the Midwest. But broadly, I'd like to, you know, think about, as the prior speakers were talking about, a more broader region. So in my mind, it's even from, you know, Ohio, West Virginia, out into eastern Oklahoma. And these are some of the areas we're looking at: Arkansas, Missouri. Haven't made it up to Iowa yet, but in that region.
Tom has something to say about that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But Kansas City is located really on the edge of the prairies to the west and the forests to the east. And so we're really at a collision of two large ecoregional zones that provides really an interesting ecology in our area.
So when we're looking at that forest piece of it, Neil, I mean, is it the case that forests in this region are endangered, or is it just that they will perhaps look different?
It's really hard to say at this point. These relationships they're finding that we're finding with summer temperatures are really interesting. You were talking about what is climate change in that region. One of the most interesting things about climate change in that region is that daytime temperatures in June, July, August in the summer have actually been declining in the last 100 years. It's a little bit, but it's called a global warming hole. It's not warming up during the daytime in the summer, and it's those summer daytime temperatures. So right now, in ways, the conditions are getting better for trees. It's getting cooler during the day in that region. But if the forecast, I was really stunned by that, 22 days above 105 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100, if that happens, there's going to be some significant impacts on the forest. There might be increased mortality. There might be a thinning of the crowns. Some species might perform better than others. It's really difficult to say right now, though, because ecology is really resilient, and it'll be, and those forests are so diverse that some species might say, well, this is no big deal, and some species might say, this really is terrible.
Neil, as I can't imagine that you would be doing the kind of work you do without being someone who loves forests.
Oh, yeah, I can't tell you how much I love forests. That's actually one of my, that's what people think of me in my science, actually. I really love the trees, and that was my first visit to that part of the world. I've studied the trees from Florida to New England and in between, and I'd never been to the Ozarks, and we were there in April. Spring was coming on, and it was just beautiful. You know, the buckeyes were starting to bloom. Oaks and the hickories and wonderful trees were coming out, but I was really surprised at the diversity. A lot of it reminded me of the Smoky Mountains. I saw silver bell, we saw black walnut, and surprisingly, you know, I'm from New England, sugar maple. We saw sugar maple in Oklahoma, and that was just really a trip, and it made me really appreciate how wonderful that area is and how diverse the forests are in the southern.
Yeah, when you were saying before that, you know, we might see some species respond either neutrally or favorably to climate change and some species not be able to withstand it, would that in and of itself put the diversity of these forests at risk?
Yeah, that actually would. I mean, you know, Tom made an excellent point about where Kansas City sits, and one reason we're studying this area is this is the transition zone from the eastern deciduous forest to the Great Plains. And so as you travel west from that area, there are forests, but it becomes more dominated by post oak and red cedar and a few other species. But if you move east, gradually you start picking up these other species. And so you can imagine, and I'm not going to say this is going to happen for sure, but you can imagine that if it becomes hotter and drier, and that boundary of increased heat and increased dryness moves east, you could imagine that maybe the post oaks and the cedars would do a little bit better, and more mesic species like maybe sugar maple or black walnut might perform worse and then become more reduced on the landscape. Now, this is really complex, though, because we sampled in some ravines and we found that they were a little less sensitive to temperature that we were seeing at the larger scale. So there would be still some pockets, but at a larger scale, it could change the biodiversity. But, you know, it's really difficult to predict at this time.
Jerry Schnorr at the University of Iowa, I mean, are there other ways in which our landscape might be changing, but not necessarily for the better or worse, just for the different?
Well, one thing I guess we haven't talked about besides the forest species would be other species of animals and plants. And certainly plants are moving continuously northward. We know that. And to higher elevations where there are hills, not so much in Iowa and Kansas. But I think that the documentation on the changes observed in animal and plant species is less than some of the other impacts that we've been talking about. But certainly things are going on there. And the water relationships, for example, we have a very interesting turtle in Iowa, and I think its range goes down to Kansas. And it is endangered because it places its eggs out in the middle of a sandy stream bed. But now with greater and greater precipitation events, the rain coming in bigger storm events, this often floods out their nests, and now that turtle is endangered. So there's lots of different aspects, but species is one we haven't talked much about.
Yeah, I do want to hear more about species. You know, Neil, can you tell us about, beyond trees, what species of perhaps animal life in the forest might be affected by the changes you've been describing?
Yeah, that's a bit out of my territory, to be honest. I'd hate to speculate on some of those things.
Understandable. Tom, I also want to talk to you about, we've talked about our area being on this line between forest and prairie. Is there any chance that that line would shift?
I don't know that I'd be prepared to respond to that one. We know that plant-soil-water relationships are going to change. We know that temperatures are going to change. It will likely affect the composition and structure of our forests and our natural landscapes. But this is a natural experiment that nobody's conducted before.
Jerry, anything you'd add?
I think that, the demarcation that Neil was talking about between the eastern deciduous forests and the plains, could change as a result of climate change. I haven't actually read any papers on that, but just speculating a little bit for a moment. East of especially the summertime and fall patterns are dominated by moisture from the Gulf of Mexico. So the question is, one reason that Kansas is in two different climatological zones is because of this influence of whether most of your weather and most of your precipitation comes from the Gulf of Mexico or whether it's coming from westerly sources. And that demarcation, I think, could change. And that makes the prediction at a regional scale for these modelers, that makes it very difficult.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll talk solutions and we'll maybe dive more into some of these problems. We'll be sticking with this climate change conversation after this break. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back. The typical climate change conversation is focused on glaciers and on coastal cities like New York someday finding themselves submerged underwater. But here in the Midwest, the story is playing out a little bit differently. We've been hearing how this morning. Our guests are Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council, Jerry Schnorr of the University of Iowa, and Neil Peterson, a Harvard researcher who's been studying forests, including Midwestern forests. So let's talk for now about solutions, because it's easy to get very overwhelmed by these issues. Tom Jacobs, you're looking at projections for the future. How much of this do you think is still in our hands?
You know, we know that change is coming. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what it looks like. But given the fact that we're looking at a future that's different than what we're facing today, we can begin to take steps that are practical or pragmatic, that create that help us create the kind of future that we want for our community. And so that's exactly the path that we're on. It was interesting, two years ago, the Mid-America Regional Council, together with the City of Kansas City, Missouri, and Johnson County, Kansas, and Bridging the Gap, a local sustainability-focused nonprofit, received a designation from the administration as a climate action champion. So we are designated by the White House and the Department of Energy. And that helped us launch a process to frame a regional or begin the development of a regional climate resilience strategy. So we're asking the questions, what are our risks and vulnerabilities? And given what we learned about that, what can we do about it? So our previous conversation about trees and forests, for example, is central to that whole conversation. We know that that's part of the answer.
So what is the strategy as of now?
Well, we're working on it. It's been really fun. We've convened hundreds of people from around the community working in diverse sectors, from energy to water to transportation to public health. And there's a lot of terrific work that's underway in our community now. And I think the whole issue of climate change creates an opportunity to build upon that work and to think about how we can adapt or respond to or bounce forward from changes in climate. So this could look like more investment in energy efficiency or renewable energy. It could be planting more trees, restoring streams. It could be producing more local food.
Can you unpack each of those a little bit? I mean, planting trees, that is something that that people have talked about really my whole life. I'm wondering what evidence we have that it makes a difference. It seems like such a small thing. And I think, yeah, people out there would like to be empowered with the idea that planting a tree could make a difference.
Well, there's a preponderance of evidence that trees make a difference. The conversation with Neil's interesting. Maybe we need to rethink exactly which kinds of trees we're planting so that they'll last far into the future. But trees help improve air quality. They improve water quality. They reduce the risk of flooding. They conserve energy because they cool the city. They create habitat. They create more walkable streets. These are all good things, and there's ample evidence to support all of that. And so we can plant trees, but we really need to replant an urban forest so that we can maximize all of these benefits that would help us to respond to increased heat, increased precipitation, things that are likely in to be in our future.
Why would
I guess one other?
Oh yeah,
that,
please jump in.
Tom didn't mention is that the trees actually help to sequester carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, a very important greenhouse gas, and put it into nice, rich organic carbon in the soil and store it there for long periods of time. So not only the storage of the carbon in the woody biomass itself, but in the soil is important to the quality of our soils and to a cleaner atmosphere. And I would also add that in solar and wind and energy conservation and efficiency, these things are all job creators. And this is, I'm absolutely convinced, the secret to the economic engine for growth in the future, jobs for our young people, and prosperity for people who recognize that this doesn't have to be painful. In fact, it could be the secret, this creative destruction of wiping out the old fossil fuel age and bringing in something new and better. That's the way to go in the future.
Neil, as someone who studies forests and what species of tree will and won't potentially thrive, going forward, is there a kind of tree that you would either discourage or encourage when you talk about planting trees to mitigate these problems?
Yeah, I think if it is really going to get so hot, and even with the expected increase in precipitation, that heat that is forecast could really overwhelm the amount of increase in moisture that the region will see. So I would look to the south, I would look to the west. And so, you know, post oak is one tree that I've already brought up. But anything like that, that seems to thrive pretty well further south, and I know you're not too far north of the Gulf, but and places to the west. So cedars and post oaks and any other drought tolerant species like that, maybe hickories. I mean, even up here in New England, in my yard, I'm putting southern species around our house just in case.
Tom, you mentioned growing your own food as a possible solution, something that might help. Why?
Well, there's a variety of reasons, but perhaps the one I'll focus on the most has to do with these issues of social equity. There are parts of our community that are known as food deserts, where there are challenges with nutrition and health concerns that arise from that. And at the same time, we spend an inordinate amount of energy importing food from all over the country, and in fact, the world. There's opportunities to grow food, to plant orchards, to plant community gardens. In fact, there's gardens that have just sprung up all over Kansas City. There's a huge amount of energy around doing that, and it's a great thing. It brings people together. It creates the opportunity for fresh produce, for increased health outcomes, and for improving communities all at the same time. So there's a whole movement afoot behind this, and it's really exciting, and it's just a win-win-win on so many different levels.
It helps with climate change, though, primarily because of the reduced energy to transport food from one place to another?
So from a climate mitigation standpoint, right, we'd be spending less energy importing food. But from a local perspective, imagine if you're a family with a limited budget, perhaps there's an opportunity to generate healthy, nutritional meals at lower cost and in a way that helps your community and your neighbors at the same time.
So this might be a tough question, but in the wake of our recent presidential election and a new attitude toward organizations like the EPA from the top, I wonder what the role of local and state government might be in addressing environmental issues. Can city and state governments have an impact?
Absolutely. There's been a movement that's been alive for well over a decade or two, where all of the action around sustainability has been at the city level. Not all of it, but there's been incredible leadership at the city level all across the country and, in fact, the world. And in Kansas City, there's a terrific number of wonderful things that are moving forward, whether it has to do with streetcar, alternative transportation, bike lanes, local food, tree planting, energy efficiency, renewable energy, all these kinds of things. And so as we've convened people through the Mid-America Regional Council, we're interacting with all the local communities in our 9-county area. And each one has its own different priorities. But these kinds of measures are embraced broadly, differently in each community, of course, according to their priorities and capabilities and interests. But the idea that we can save energy, make energy more affordable, use our resources more efficiently, that we can conserve nature while we develop and create economic opportunity in ways that are softer on the environment or, in fact, restore the environment. These are all ideas that I think are broadly embraced and can be translated into actions and investments in ways that are locally appropriate.
Our city and states, of course, exist within the country. So, I mean, how does the recent presidential election potentially shape some of the scenarios you've described?
Well, surely the national political situation will affect us. But I think what's important to us in Kansas City is we've defined a path forward for ourselves that's about creating a sustainable future for Kansas City. And we can identify strategies that we can support and implement. And we can do so in ways that maximize the public health benefits, the environmental benefits, the economic and job creation opportunities. And we can try and align those with state and federal actions where it makes sense to do so. But I think it's important to note that we've already begun taking a whole set of actions over the last decade, and there's a lot of power and momentum behind that. And I think that there's a lot of local interest and will and continuing to move that forward.
Jerry, anything you'd like to add on that?
Well, I'd just like to emphasize again that the movement away from fossil fuels is really an opportunity, an economic opportunity. For example, in Iowa now, 35% of our electricity demand is fulfilled by wind power, and farmers are benefiting from the leases of wind turbines on their land, getting a good income from that. And Kansas could do likewise, and certainly Kansas has a wonderful capacity for solar power. You know, when the wind's not blowing, often the sun is shining and brightly, as Neil told us. And so we've created in Iowa over 6,000 high-quality, high-paying jobs as a result of the wind industry alone. That doesn't count insulation and energy efficiency and all the many, many jobs that can be created in responding to this. So I'd like to leave the listeners with the idea that this is an opportunity that we need to take advantage of.
You did mention farmers and wind energy, and I want to ask you about the agricultural realm within this conversation, because a lot of the land in the Midwest is agricultural. How do you see agriculture being affected by climate change? I mean, how has it already been affected?
Well, it's already been affected by longer growing seasons. We talked about that, and emphasis on droughts and floods. They have to respond to whatever the climate, in this case the weather, is dealing to farmers and to federal programs as well. So, but there are, I think, some opportunities emerging there as well. Tom Vilsack, the USDA administrator, has launched the Climate Smart Agriculture Program, in which there's economic opportunities for farmers who participate in putting more organic carbon into their soils and farming in such a way that subsidies are available to improve the farm, decrease soil erosion for the long term for our kids, and also make money out of it. So there are opportunities for farmers, to be sure.
On this note about alternative forms of energy, Tom, I mean, you mentioned that is one area where we can turn our attention. What are the opportunities for that that the Mid-America Regional Council already knows about and has already been pursuing?
I'd agree completely. There's enormous solar potential in our area and in Kansas and Missouri, a lot of wind potential. And it's amazing to see how those two industries are just exploding. The cost of solar has declined dramatically over the last few years, and you see it. And
when you talk about solar, I mean, are you talking about the idea that maybe individual homes would start to be solar powered and their for their energy consumption, things like that?
Yeah, it could be at a residential or a commercial level. I'm not talking about the industrial scale solar.
Why don't we already see more of that? It is a little bit, I mean, is it mostly the cost thing or is there something else? Because solar energy has been around for a long time.
The technologies have continued to improve and the costs have declined. It's subject to global markets. It's subject to political and local and federal policies. But the costs have declined and it is going in. And so I think I see more of it around Kansas City than I ever have before, and I'm sure that that trend will continue.
Gina, if you're talking about solar power plants, those are dominant in the western United States where the solar potential is even greater than in Kansas. So maybe, again, at the local home and farm level is where the expansion should take place.
Neil, anything you'd like to leave us on as far as the future of the forests are concerned?
Well, I think forests might be more resilient than we expect. They're really genetically diverse and adaptive. So I think we should hold on and hope and that they can handle it.
Our time is up. Jerry Schnorr, thanks for talking to us from the University of Iowa this morning.
Thanks, Gina.
Jerry's a professor of civil and environmental engineering, and he co-directs the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research. Tom Jacobs, director of environmental programs at the Mid-America Regional Council, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And Neil Peterson, our forest expert with us from Harvard, thank you.
Thank you. It was an honor.
If you missed some of this conversation and you'd like to catch it later, it'll be ready for you at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we'll have the story of a Guatemalan embroidery artist whose work is on display at a local gallery. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. Our interns are Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.